right, 10 minutes after 9 o'clock. You've got it on KHUM. And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. This is our 20th as time marches on. We are dealing this week, or this entire campaign, with privilege, prejudice, and the violence of otherism. And this week, specifically focusing on celebrating allies. And joining me via telephone this morning, we've got a terrific ally. This is Marianne Pennekamp. How are you doing, Marianne?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. Been a while since I saw you. You were at our healing breakfast a few years back as our keynote speaker.
I don't even remember that, but I know I've done it.
Well, it hasn't been that long. Anyway, let's give a little bit of background about who you are.
Okay, who I am.
Yeah, and well, your work and your
what's significant in my life, the significant themes are, number one, I'm a refugee from Europe. During the time of Hitler and World War II, when we were stuck in France and almost did not make it out alive. So surviving and celebrating life every day is part of my background. I was 17 when we arrived in the United States.
Wow.
Right. Having lived in Germany for 10 years, where I was born, and then in France, for seven, where I went to secondary school. There we were refugees, and that was difficult too, but I benefited from all those, you know, three cultures that I grew up in, German and French and now American. Because that's an important part of who I am, and I always want to make sure that I acknowledge that.
You were mentioning that you're saying that you hope that your accent is not going to be a problem. I said you remind me of my grandparents. All four of my grandparents came from Europe, mostly from Eastern Europe, and you know, all had accents similar to yours.
Okay.
So it's like old home week.
Okay. Good. Good. Good.
Fantastic.
The second phase of my life, that's a theme in my life that's very important, is during those years in Germany and France, and also right away in the United States, I was supported and encouraged by my teachers. I always had a lot of support from teachers. And so when I moved along toward choosing a profession, I was torn between two possibilities. One was I was extremely interested in history and was encouraged to become a professor of history, but we couldn't afford for me to get a doctorate, to be in school that long. I was newly married, newly mom. We had very little money, so something had to occur that would give us more of an income more quickly. And so I decided that the lives of people were also a facet of history. And if I worked as a social worker, I would work with people and their lives. And that's where I engaged. And because schools and teachers had been so helpful to me, I wanted to work with children in schools and make sure they got the same support along their path that I had gotten as I came up. So that explains why I became a school social worker.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
And after 2 years in a children's treatment institution where I worked as a social worker, I got a job in the Oakland Public Schools, and I worked there for 25 years.
Wow!
Now
you
so
did. You actually did wind up getting.
Career.
You actually did wind up getting your PhD from Berkeley, right?
And I did. Yeah, somewhere along the way, actually, friends and family said, you know, they want you as a teacher, and they said that you could come and get your PhD, it's time to do it, because the work in the Oakland Public Schools was physically very draining. You know, it was from 8 in the morning until 5:30 in the afternoon. Not that those were required times, but that was the actual times. And on my feet and running around and interacting every minute of that time. And my husband said, you know, you're not going to be able to survive that once you turn into your 60s. Yeah, let's do this other thing. And he was very supportive of my getting a doctorate at Berkeley in 1975.
Wow. So you clearly made it past your 60s. You're in your 90s now, is that correct?
I'm 91, yes.
91. Fantastic.
Right.
Fantastic. So let's talk about being a social worker at Oakland Public Schools. I mean, that is almost being a professional ally.
Oh, it is not almost. That
is
where I learned to become a professional ally. Today we say it takes a village to raise a child. That's kind of new language.
Right.
But the language I developed and my peers developed in the jobs in Oakland is that every voice needs to be heard. And so working with the voice of the child, the teacher, the administrator, principal, whoever, the parents, and the community was extremely important to make it possible to adapt the general education to the needs of different kinds of children with different issues. And so that's where I learned that it takes allies, that the professional can't fix anything in a vacuum. And the longer I live, the more I really believe that, because so many people need some sort of warmth, outreach, and support, that professionals by themselves will never be able to meet all the needs, that it takes peer helping. It takes parent support groups. It takes learning communities for the professionals, ongoing learning, and it takes support for the children as individuals, as small groups, as classroom-based, and then also the school climate, so that the school is a warm, supportive environment, that it's not driven by fear, not driven by punishment. And that's a movement that's underway in education as we speak.
Terrific. Now, your background, we're of course, this campaign dealing with prejudice, privilege, and the
right.
violence of otherism. Your background during World War II, that is taking prejudice and violence of otherism to an extreme. That is the outcome of when you take the other as far as you can, and you begin to they were so otherized in Europe that
right.
began to exterminate an entire population.
Right, right. Absolutely, and that's exactly what our experience was. And if it hadn't been, in my particular, many people helped, that's quietly, many of them. Some we knew who they were, some we didn't. There was a consul at the American consulate in Marseille, where we lived, who saw what was coming down the pike, and that extermination was the next step for many of the people who were trying to get visas to come to the United States. It's probably not going to go over very well, but the policy of the State Department was anti-immigrant even then. Some of the themes we hear now, some of the fears we hear now, there was a lot of the same thing going on then. And you no matter how many papers you had to say that you would not be a charge to the state, that there was family help going to help you get established, it was never enough. And this vice consul finally decided that this was too dangerous for many of the people. And there was a ship became available that was going from Marseille. This was before the days of flying. It was going from Marseille to the Caribbean, and from the Caribbean there was shipping to New York. And he said, "This it's now or never." And they produced about, 1,200 to 1,500 visas of people who were already in the pipelines. Working 24/7 for 2 or 3 days, and the French authorities collaborated and provided exit visas. so that he had a place to put the American visa because we no longer had a valid passport. Just to give you an impression of how complicated it was.
Wow.
And we left and we survived.
You know, it's kind of interesting when you take a look at the history of this country. This is a country built of immigrants. This is a whole country is a country of immigrants. I mean, the only ones who can claim that they are not are Native Americans, and they are clearly the minority. So it seems kind of strange that we go through this every few years where we become very anti-immigrant and xenophobic, and it doesn't seem to make any sense.
Well, I agree. You know, people are afraid of change. And what I'm hearing a lot right now is, oh, we won't be the same country with all those immigrants. And that applies mostly to the Latino immigrants.
Well, that is true. It changes. The country evolves as new people come in. That's part of the beauty of this country.
But people are afraid of change. We all are. And I just... I understand that. I don't agree with it at all. Of course not. But I understand that people want to be comfortable in what they've known for generations. And change is always difficult. The fact that change is happening worldwide right now, whether you want it or not, whether to do with immigrants or not, that our whole future in how we're going to live economically is changing, I think it's still very scary for people to look at.
Absolutely. No doubt about that. Now, you know, a lot of people who emigrated from Europe, after a generation where the accents become just standard American, blend in as just your average white American, but... immigrants coming from other countries where the skin color is different or eyes look different will look different from the white population for generations. And that seems to be where our problems are now. We seem to have we still seem to have issues with people of color in this country, which is remarkable. I mean, I'm only a second generation American. You know, many of my friends who are of color have been in this country for generations, but still are persecuted because of the color of their skin.
Right. I just want to say one thing. My experience, in addition to what you just said, is that also poor whites are also having a very hard time.
Mm-hmm.
In Humboldt County, poverty is not so much of color as it is of employment or lack of it. When the wood industry, lumber industry went down, when the jobs in the woods disappeared, which we could one could make a very decent living at with an eighth grade education or even less, the lack of new jobs in this area for people with limited academic backgrounds is a huge issue, and we have problems in Humboldt County with children of poverty.
Absolutely. And poverty is another otherism. You know,
right. So it's important to add poverty to the racial profiling stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, it's... so, obviously, you know, you are currently retired. You were in Oakland City Schools for a long time, and it was a different era. But I would imagine a lot of the issues you had to deal with are kind of the same ones that are still around today.
Well, yes. They say in Europe, they say more it's different, the more it's the same thing.
Uh-huh.
There are variations on the theme, and you have to be sensitive to cultural variations. But other than that, the problems are very similar. And actually, the problems that we experience now, regardless of where we are, but they're particularly poignant in rural counties because we don't have access to the same resources as the big cities do. So they're particularly often somewhat intractable. And that is that there before that, for instance, my job in Oakland was I was on the General Education Fund, paid like a teacher or an administrator or whatever. Today, people in my job roles are paid by what we call siloed funding. Siloed funding is funding that comes down specially labeled, or it has to be spent for a particular task. That was to make sure, for instance, that children of poverty get extra resources in their schools, and that seemed like a good idea. But now these silos separate, it's complicated, they separate how services can be delivered. For instance, there is a silo around special education, children who need special educational services. That was supposed to be 10%, but it's now understand can go as high as 20%. That's a lot of kids.
Wow.
There's a silo for children of poverty. When I mean silo, I mean funding streams.
Got it.
Then there's a silo for children's mental health. There's a silo for health. The funding streams come so separate that the lives of the children, holistic lives, you know, the way children live from day to day, are not supported. What's supported is that special piece of their lives. And that is very difficult to integrate. So we have fiscally, we have interests that almost compete with each other. And I find it difficult to integrate and serve the whole child in a holistic manner, meaning wherever that child's life is happening, at home, in preschool, in schools, you know, for the longest period of time, from kindergarten through the 12th grade, that's a long stretch of time.
Sure.
On the playground, after-school programming, etc. So that, for instance, children need to come to a they used to, if we're actually changing as rapidly, that's part of the work of being allies right now, is that we are beginning to move toward creating alliances and rejoining what has been torn apart in terms of the actual program delivery. That program delivery happens as close to the family, as close to the environment where a child actually spends the time, meaning the school or the after-school program, as possible, so that people don't have to go across town without transportation issues, spending valuable time just getting there, and then being seen for an hour or 50-minute hour in a mental health interview, and then going back, having lost school time, and the parents, most of whom are working, having lost work time. So we're now beginning to move services close to where the children live and go to school. That's a huge step in the right direction in terms of being allies.
That's good to hear. Let me ask you this before we run out of time, which is coming up on us quickly. Time really just goes by so fast. Now, you have been a social worker for a long time, and as we said, that is being a professional ally. What advice would you give to just the average person, how they can be an ally?
That's an excellent question. Know your neighbors. Don't be nosy, but be there for them. Nosy means, asking too many questions.
Mm-hmm.
Not being nosy, saying, it's raining today, and I know your child has got to walk to school, and it's a mile. I'm driving mine. Can I take yours? You know, mm-hmm. Extending oneself to be supportive is a good, being a good neighbor. That's one way. The other way is, and we're beginning to talk about that, and as a beginning effort to get that moving, is to develop peer support, meaning if there are several parents who are anxious about their children, either in their preschool, their school, whatever, that they come together and say, how do we help each other work well with the school? How do we help each other get to the doc, find out where the best doctor is that can take care of our children, that kind of peer support. And there's mm-hmm. some beginning of that. Those are the kinds of steps, self-help steps, that could be, and there's the family resource centers, very important mm-hmm. in most of our communities, and they are the logical site for bringing people together.
Fantastic. Well,
so find your family resource center or call a family resource center and get a list of where they are. There are about 14 of them in Humboldt County. And they are places where there's at least a person. And there's one more resource, and that's 211. It's a telephone number you call, 211, that if you need to find out where you can get a certain service, you can call 211 and they'll help you find the service and how to get there.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Mary Ann Pennekamp, thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us this morning.
Well, whatever I shared, it's my day-to-day passion. So.
Well, good day-to-day stuff.
Okay, thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you again so much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That is Mary Ann Pennekamp, retired social worker in Oakland City Schools and just all-around great person for our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. Join me tomorrow morning at 9. My guest is going to be Dr. Renee Bird. She is an assistant professor of sociology at HSU, and she will be wearing several hats and talking about several different things. She'll be talking about the U.S. justice system and the prison systems and the imbalance of people of color in them, representing the Black Lives Matter movement as well, amongst many other things that we'll be talking about. That is Dr. Renee Bird, and that is tomorrow morning at 9.